Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Think of it this way. You have more microbial cells than you have human cells. To be exact, 100 trillion bacterial and fungal cells to a mere 30 million human cells. Makes you think. In fact, they make you able to do all the important things you do. Without them, you would die. Without us, they'd manage okay. If that makes you feel small or unimportant, remember that there is always something larger than us, like the planet, for instance. Anywhere you look, on and in this planet, there are organisms living in a delicate balance of ecology. Today's guest was paying attention when he discovered that what's killing us and making us sick might just be the sort of imbalance. Join us today as we learn why our war against germs might be destroying our best allies. First, some thoughts from Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. Food is less nutritious than it used to be. Compared to values from 1950, the first year for which there are data, nutrients in crops have declined up to 40%. For example, a serving of broccoli eaten in 1950 had significantly more vitamin C, B vitamins, calcium, and other nutrients than the same size serving of broccoli eaten today. In other words, to get the same nutrients today, you'd have to eat up to 40% more food. The Organic Center report that describes this degradation notes that although organic produce is more nutrient-dense than industrial produce, nevertheless, organic nutrient density has also declined. Productivity is the cause cited in the report. Growers are driven to increase the yield of crops for each acre. But as plants grow faster and bigger, plant metabolism limits the rate of nutrient uptake. Increasing yields is driven by economics. Get the biggest bang for a buck. In this case, the bang is a head of cauliflower or other food crop. There's another and more disturbing limitation that's discussed among soil scientists. Peak soil. The idea of peak soil borrows from the idea of peak oil. Oil is a finite resource extracted to exhaustion. Soil, as the source of crop nutrients, is a finite resource also extracted to exhaustion. The soil scientist David Montgomery observes that while the threat of disappearing petroleum is well understood generally, quote, a crisis in global agriculture remains hidden. We are, and have long been, using up the supply of topsoil we rely on to grow our food, end quote. Montgomery argues that not just industrial agriculture, but agriculture based on tillage, that is, the plowing of the soil, is responsible for the degradation of soil ecologies in two ways. First, it literally opens the ground to erosion from wind and water so that the nutritious topsoil is blown and washed away. Second, the soil ecology that transforms mineral dirt into usable nutrients and that cooperates with plant root systems in supplying plants with those nutrients is torn asunder, then blown and washed away. Although historically the yield of each acre put under the plow has increased since the introduction of agriculture 10,000 or so years ago, that general fact ignores wide areas that were once productive but are now barren because of tillage-based agriculture. Montgomery and his colleagues warned that those times are coming to the current breadbaskets of the world and sooner than we'd like. So on the demand side, food is less nutritious because of industrial agriculture that artificially increases crop yields so that the plant's capacity to take up nutrients from the soil is outstripped by its growth rate. On the supply side, tillage strips away nutrients available to crops. As I'm sure you can imagine, there are a number of more of the same answers to this problem. One is referred to as remineralization. Cook up nutrients in industrial labs and add them to dirt. Unfortunately, those nutrients are finite resources themselves. At some point, we'd run out of them. Another solution is genetically engineered crops that are more efficient in extracting nutrients from soil. Aside from the fantasy that GMO will feed the world with little more than PR for scientific evidence, It does nothing for the health of the soil itself. The same answer is what's referred to as agroecology, the design and management of food systems based on ecological integration. A lot's packed into that, but practically what it says is that agroecology is a technology used to grow and distribute nutrient-dense food, integrate the farm into the local culture, political economy, and ecology, and improve and maintain the health of the soil. This isn't a fringe idea. The UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food says that the new green revolution is agroecology. But that's not the direction in which feeding the world is headed. For example, there's an organization called Peak Soil Indexes that is creating what it calls investment opportunities for the purchase of farmland as a commodity. Since the financial crisis of 2009, investment capital has flooded the Third World, especially Africa, to buy up farmland from small farmers. As a consequence, farm productivity has dropped. Why is that? Because investment capital isn't interested in tending the land and growing food, it's interested in growing money. Farmland has become one of the latest speculative bubbles. Productivity drops either because land is taken out of production or because any farming that takes place is industrial farming, you know, the kind that's hell on wheels for degrading the nutrient value of crops and the soil from which they grow. It turns out that worldwide, small farmers produce 70% of food on 25% of the land. That is, of all the land in the world being farmed, one quarter, 25%, is cultivated by small farmers. Those small farms produce over two-thirds of the food people actually eat. Many of those small farms use traditional methods that approximate agroecological practices. So although nutrient degradation and peak soil appear as technical problems, as being about agricultural practices, as being about the adoption of ecologically sane technologies by farmers, in fact, nutrient degradation and peak soil are problems of political economy. What I mean is that the politics are not about encouraging the right kind of technology, but about making sure we have the right kind of land ownership. And if you think this is exclusively a third world problem, think again. The speculator's friend, Peak Soil Indexes, is all about finding farmland investments in the United States, a speculative bubble that is expected to make half of all small farms disappear over the next decade. More nutritious food? Feed the world? Sure thing. Shop agroecology. Grow your own agroecologically. Organize against industrial agriculture. A transcript is available at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeff Fawcett is a political economist, writer, and health integrationist who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to today's topic, which is the microbiome, the ecology of who we are. And our guest is Dr. Martin L. Blaser. He is the Muriel G. and George W. Singer Professor of Translational Medicine, Director of the NYU Human Microbiome Program, former Chair of the Department of Medicine, and Professor of Microbiology at New York University School of Medicine. In 2013, he was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Science. He is an established researcher in microbiology and infectious diseases. Blaser's work has focused primarily on the human microbiome. He was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2013, and he has a book out which is called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues, among other things. We're very grateful that you were able to join us. Welcome to you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, yes. Your book is really splendid. I was thrilled with it. It explains, for one thing, why... I mean, this is not a book that could be titled 5 Weeks to a Healthier gut, or you know, it's not a how-to book as much as it really does take on the challenge of educating not only lay people but physicians and other people on why it's so important to pay attention to the ecology of our bodies as much as we're trying to pay attention to the ecology of the planet in this climate crisis that we're having. Now, most of the discussion about the microbiome is centered on the stomach and the gut, and a lot goes on there that's significant. You talk about the bacteria that help us get nutrients from our food and metabolize and clear our hormones. But these intelligent cells are maintaining balance all over, both inside and outside of us. So I'd like you to say more about that, if you could.
Well, your summary is great. The reason that I wrote Missing Microbes is 50 years ago, Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring to wake everybody up to what was happening with pesticides. And this is my attempt 50 years later to give us a similar kind of wake-up call, because just as we're damaging our external environment through global warming and many other pernicious trends, we're also damaging our internal environment. There's more and more evidence that our microbiome, as you describe it, the ancient organisms that we have co-evolved with since time immemorial, is becoming degraded, that we're losing some of our beneficial microbes, some of the microbes that are our friends. So many people think that all germs are bad, but they're not. We live in a world that's full of bacteria. Most of them are neutral to us. Some of them are actually quite good for us. As you said before, we can't live without them. We've co-evolved with them. We've acquired many of them from our mothers, and she acquired it from her mother, and so on and so forth, into time immemorial. And these microbes do particular jobs for us. They help protect us from invaders. They train our immune system. They help us digest our food. They make vitamins for us. So most of the bacteria in our body are quite good for us, and we are losing some of them because of some of the advances in medicine, like antibiotics, for example.
Yeah, there's go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Antibiotics are amazing drugs. When they first came on the scene in the 1930s and the 1940s, they were miraculous. They cured people who were on the brink of death. Even today, they cure people who are on the brink of death. These are very seriously ill people with serious bacterial infections. But because antibiotics are so good, doctors have been using them more and more and more. And people expect to receive antibiotics even for very minor illnesses. Illnesses for which, in fact, there's no basis to give antibiotics at all. Yet doctors prescribe them, patients want them. So we have been doing research that provides evidence that these antibiotics have cost, that they're not free, not just financial cost, but biological cost, and that every time you take an antibiotic, there is some effect on the system. Maybe a few of those ancient organisms might go extinct. You may lose them forever. Now, if you're seriously ill, that's not of any consequence at all. It's better to be treated if you're seriously ill. But if you're minorly ill and you get antibiotics again and again and again, there could be consequence. Recent studies by the Centers for Disease Control suggest that the average person in the United States gets the average child gets more than 10 courses of antibiotics by the time they're 10, and about 17 courses by the time they're 20. So that's across all the kids in the United States. It's an enormous antibiotic burden, and our research is providing evidence that this has cost, that it's changing our metabolism, that it's changing our immunity.
You're listening to an interview with Dr. Martin Blaser, B-L-A-S-E-R-M-D. He is the author of the new book, Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. You talk about how drastically our microbiome has been reduced, how people's colonies has been lost, you know, sometimes as much as 40%. And as we both said in the beginning of the program, there's more of them than there is of us. There's more, we have more microbial DNA than we do human DNA. So these creatures, as you say, are not only symbiotic, but we don't even know the depth of how important they are. We're just beginning to scratch the surface and understanding how one bacteria might protect us from another because of the proper balance. One of the things that's distressing is that antibiotics are sometimes used prophylactically, like to prevent acne in teenagers, instead of looking at other issues that may be skewing their hormone balance, because using the antibiotics is going to skew things too. And then they sometimes give it to women who have recurrent bladder infections, again, instead of looking at the underlying cause for that condition. So, you know, your book is much more than this, but it is a profound thesis that ends with the concept that we have to very much limit the use of antibiotics and discover ways to use them with some pre-testing to determine what it is that you're actually treating, instead of, you know, having somebody with an illness that looks terrible and you think, well, we don't know whether it's viral or bacterial, so let's just give them an antibiotic. And that clearly has to stop.
Well, again, this is a matter of the judgment, clinical judgment. That's why we have doctors, because if somebody is really sick, they need an antibiotic. But it's really not up to the person to decide. In the United States, you have to get a prescription for an antibiotic. In China, there are no prescriptions for antibiotics. In India, there aren't prescriptions. Antibiotics in China are used 2 to 4 times as much as they're used here. In many countries of the world, people don't feel well, they take an antibiotic, thinking, well, maybe it'll help. I'm concerned that if we summate all of that use, that the risk, the harm exceeds the benefit.
Well, a really nasty virus will present in some cases like a bacterial infection. I mean, you can
yes.
even get a spiking fever. You can even
yes.
get
yes.
green
Absolutely.
Mucus. I mean, you can get all of it with a virus. And viruses are just not interested in antibiotics much. I mean, they may get a slight effect from the anti-inflammatory,
no,
but
don't.
No, they don't respond.
That's a myth.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I point out in Missing Microbes is that I compare the United States with Sweden. Sweden is a country, an advanced country. The longevity is longer in Sweden. The people in Sweden are at least as healthy as we are.
Oh, so healthier, I believe.
Yeah, probably.
No, well, I mean, if you look at the...
I say at least as healthy.
Yeah, no, but if you look at early morbidity, the United States and infant mortality, we're 37th.
So, the point I want to make is that Sweden uses only 40% of the antibiotics we use per capita at every age. For when our kids are 10 and they've had 10 courses of antibiotics, the kids in Sweden have had only 4. Yet those kids seem to be doing just as well as us, maybe even better. And these kinds of statistics suggest that 60% of the antibiotics that we're using just off the top are unneeded. That's assuming that all the use in Sweden is perfect as well. So, and pediatricians have long known that we're overusing antibiotics. Family doctors know this, and yet no one will bite the bullet. No parent will say, well, for my child, you know, I don't want to get an antibiotic. But what I'm proposing is an extension of what we know already, and that is the more judicious use of antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
If a parent has a child who's ill, they should go see a doctor or another health professional. And the doctor should do a careful exam on that child, not an exam where everybody's hurried because there's no time, but a careful exam. And if the doctor says to the parent, your child doesn't need an antibiotic, that parent should feel relieved because their child isn't that sick. And rather than feel deprived, you know, what is my child missing? And it's because, I didn't mention this, but we have evidence that that antibiotics, especially in children, may be contributing to the the current what I call modern plagues of obesity, juvenile diabetes, food allergies, asthma, and other related conditions that have skyrocketed in recent decades. And we have studies in mice that support all of these findings.
Yes, and you explain all of it in the book very clearly. You're not, you know, on the simplistic level, you're disturbing the gut a lot, and there's pathologies like IBS and IBD and celiacs and Crohn's, and so the immune system is crashing because there's, again, to use the word ecology, there's an ecology in the body, on the skin, in the nose, in every crevice, in your tangential area, under your arms, everywhere there are these creatures growing, and they have worked out their environments, and they protect their environments, and in doing so, often protect us, and it is an imbalance in this ecology that makes us really ill in many cases, or
let me just say, I wouldn't use the term that our immune system is crashing.
Okay.
We're particularly interested in how the immune system develops in babies, in children. And will it develop normally?
Right.
Or will that child have a tendency toward allergies or a tendency toward inflammatory bowel disease or asthma? And again, our research and the research of other scientists is suggesting that this early life is very important for development. Well, we know that already, that early life is important for development.
And
it
determines
how tall a baby is going to be and many other features, their intelligence. And so there's more and more evidence that our microbes are our partners in healthy development.
Right.
And although we have good intentions, we seem to be messing it up.
Well, right away, right at birth. Like before birth,
yes.
During birth, after birth, through C-sections, you know, they're doing a drip intravenously. I mean, it's just this onslaught of antibiotics.
Yes, and this leads to the discussion about cesarean sections, because cesarean sections became safe about 100 years ago, a little more than 100 years ago. And in some cases, they're life-saving, saving the life of the baby, saving the life of the mother. But today, one out of every three babies in the United States is born by C-section. In the Netherlands, it's about 12%. So about, we're doing it about three times as much. And 20 years ago, we were only at 18%. So it's really grown dramatically. In countries like Brazil, it's 50%. In Rome, Italy, it's 80%.
It's a convenience. It becomes a convenience.
It's a variety of different factors. Everybody thinks it's free, that you can do a C-section and that, it's more convenient for the mom, it's more convenient for the doctor, for the hospital. Many women are told that their pelvis is too small, they won't have the baby, but I'm not sure that the pelvis was too small 30 years ago. And it's become smaller now. So everything would be fine if C-section didn't have cost. But what we know is that when a baby is born, let me go back a step and say that we humans are mammals. And for the last 100 million years, all mammals are born through the vagina, through passage through the birth canal. And when a baby is born through the birth canal, they begin to acquire microbes from their mother. They're coated with microbes. They swallow the mother's microbes. So it's in their mouth, on their skin, and that's how the baby comes out in the world. That's their start, their founding microbes in the world. And, of course, with C-section, that's not what happens at all. And there's increasing evidence that the microbiome that colonizes babies immediately early in life is different than if they're born by C-section than vaginally.
Go ahead.
And now there have been several large studies, including studies that we have done, that show that babies born by C-section have increased health risk later in life, maybe a decade later, two decades later, increased risk of obesity. There's increased risk of asthma, juvenile diabetes, celiac disease. These have all been shown as risks that no one anticipated that are now associated with C-sections.
You also talk about the fact that the baby comes out and gets coated with microbes and is covered in the vernix, which I believe is the afterbirth, no?
No, it's the afterbirth is
something.
The placenta.
Oh, the placenta is the afterbirth. The vernix is the coating.
The vernix is this kind of a waxy coating. Mm-hmm. The baby comes out with this white, waxy coating, and everybody's in a big hurry to wash that off. And maybe that's right, although I kind of think that nature probably had some purpose mm-hmm. for giving that vernix coating.
Mm-hmm.
And although we don't know what it is, but it's a very complex substance. It's composed of hundreds of different substances. And vernix seems to have done fine for us for the last few million years. I just wonder if we're doing the baby a favor.
Yep. And then there's going back to the C-section. Women get antibiotics because of the C-section, it's, again, prophylactic to prevent an infection. And then we have antibiotics to protect from group B strep and eye drops with antibiotics. Now, group B strep, as you point out, is nasty, but it's a very, very unusual occurrence. And yet women are being treated with antibiotics, sometimes without even realizing it during the birth process in a hospital.
Yeah, so right now, about a third of all the mothers and babies in the United States, who are the babies born in the United States, are getting antibiotics to prevent group B strep. That comes out to more than 1 million babies a year.
Yep.
And that's to prevent a very serious infection caused by a bacterium called group B strep. But we know that for every case of group B strep prevented, about 200 mothers and babies are being treated. So it's a massive overtreatment. Now, if antibiotics had no cost, it would be no problem. We would be preventing a serious infection at no cost. But the question is, what's the cost of all in those other 199 people? What's the cost of getting the antibiotic? And that's one of the issues I discuss in Missing Microbes, because we have to begin to recalculate risk. And also we have to develop better diagnostic tools. We should be able to tell which babies in particular are going to be at risk for group B strep. Not every mother who carries group B strep is really a risk to their child. So some children are at higher risk than others. So if we could develop better diagnostic tests so that we only had to treat 10 moms to prevent one infection, then those other 190 moms would be doing, those 190 babies would be starting life free of antibiotics.
I should mention here also that researchers have actually tested babies born after C-section and babies born vaginally to compare. And what happens with the C-section babies is that they don't get any microbes from the mother, but they pick up a bunch of stuff from the hospital room. So
yeah,
they get populated with these other things. And again, we've mentioned this before on the show, but a vaginal swab can be done ahead of the birth and then applied to the baby after birth to help to try to repopulate with the proper microbes. Now, we have just a couple, we have about a minute and a half before we take a short musical break, but even if you avoid antibiotics, there's antibiotics in our food, in our milk, and our water system, and therefore on our plants. So we're getting antibiotics in industrially raised food, too.
Absolutely. About 70 years ago, farmers discovered that if they fed low doses of antibiotics to their farm animals would gain weight. That's what's called growth promotion. And it works. That's why they use it so much. It's estimated that about 70 or 80% of all the antibiotics sold in the United States are sold for use on the farm, especially for growth promotion. So when you eat food, meat or milk, sometimes you're getting trace levels of antibiotics in your food. For some communities, the water intake is right downstream of the effluent from industrial farms. So millions of people are being exposed to trace levels of antibiotics every day. What's the consequence of this? We don't know, but we need to know. This has to be studied.
Well, it's also getting urinated out by people who are taking lots of antibiotics, so it's going back into the water system that way, too.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So we are on the phone today with Martin J. Blaser, MD. His book is Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. We're going to take a very brief musical break, and we'll come back to this interview. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier, extended access to our over 500 archive shows with our library card feature. Find information about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more. It's all at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, please don't hesitate to email admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Dr. Blaser, you have an interesting website as well, if you could tell us.
Well, I'm an active researcher at New York University. My lab website, we call it Blaser Lab, and we feature some of the publications, some of the research that we've been doing, and of course we invite everyone to take a look.
And the website for that is, again?
You know, I have to look it up.
Oh,
myself.
Okay. Well, we'll look it. We'll get it, and we'll put it on our website for people to link to. We'll put it up there for people to go
Good.
To.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that's really interesting about your research is that you've exploded a myth. Well, you've you're thinking critically. You're thinking very critically, and as a result of thinking critically, you're asking very important questions about whether or not certain bacteria that we're hosting that have been demonized as being a problem may have beneficial effects. And one of the most interesting one is the concept that maybe gut inflammation is a normal thing, and that H. pylori maybe has a role in protecting, in this case, clearly the esophagus. And people have less allergy and asthma and hay fever with it. They have more lymphocytes and T regulation cells. So it helps to preserve immunity, but in some cases it causes ulcers. So, but eradicating H. pylori may be one of the linchpins that's bringing down the house of cards for some people.
Well, it's a very complicated topic, and that's why I deal with it, I think, in three chapters in Missing Microbes.
Yes.
Because H. pylori was discovered in 1982 by two Australians, Dr. Robin Warren and Dr. Barry Marshall. They found it in the stomach of people. Dr. Warren, a pathologist, found that those people, when he looked at their stomach under the microscope, they had a certain kind of inflammation that was called gastritis. And they deduced that these organisms were associated with ulcers, stomach ulcers and duodenal ulcers. And they showed that if they treated people with antibiotics that eradicated this organism, that removed it from the stomach, those ulcers would heal. And that radically changed the treatment of ulcer disease. People used to be treated with antacids for years or surgery. So it changed the practice of medicine. And this was a huge advance. And, in fact, they won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for this in recognition of their discovery of H. pylori and its relationship with ulcer disease. And I was involved in, I've been working on this bacteria for about 30 years now. Since their discovery, we were involved showing this the bacteria was related to stomach cancer as well, one of the worst forms of cancer there is. So everything pointed to H. pylori being a terrible villain, one of those bad germs that everybody should get rid of. But then the story became more complex, because over time, I realized, and others began to realize, that we humans have been carrying H. pylori for a very long time. In fact, the evidence is that we've had H. pylori in our stomach ever since we were humans, going back probably 200,000 years or more, probably more than that, because every animal that we look at has their own Helicobacter. And it's acquired very early in life, and it looks like one of the ordinary organisms that people have, except it's not on the skin, it's not in the colon, it's in the stomach. And it became clear to me that Helicobacter pylori is one of our microbiota. It's part of our microbiome. And yet, over the course of the 20th century, it has been disappearing. And that was kind of a new idea, because our normal organisms aren't supposed to disappear. But now, of course, we know that other organisms disappear. Animals go extinct. Plants go extinct. And so it turns out that microbes can go extinct also. And so my idea was that if you have an organism that's been with us so long and it's going extinct, there have to be consequences. And there are some important consequences. One is that there's less ulcer disease, and the other is that there's less stomach cancer. So that's actually very good news. And that's where most of the doctors of the world are at right now. They think Helicobacter is causing ulcers, is causing stomach cancer. Let's get rid of it from everybody. But on the other hand, there's new evidence that suggests that Helicobacter is protective of our esophagus. And that's important because as ulcer disease is declining, esophageal disease is increasing. There's a very common condition called reflux esophagitis, or it's also called GERD. Many of the listeners on this radio show have GERD themselves. And I can tell you that 100 years ago, GERD was much less common than it is today. The incidence of this disease has gone up. And we and others have tied that to the loss of H. pylori. So if I had to summarize a wide body of data, I would say that H. pylori is bad for your stomach, but it's good for your esophagus. And people who don't have it, and the fact that Helicobacter is disappearing helps explain why GERD is rising. After we studied GERD, we began to study asthma, because that's another disease that's rising that sometimes is associated with GERD. And we found important evidence that Helicobacter is protective against asthma as well.
I just had a thought to throw in. H. pylori had been very successful at populating the gut because it likes acid and other bacteria don't. So one of the thoughts I have is that if somebody has... here's one scenario. A child, you talk about how certainly the early baby boom babies were treated a lot with antibiotics to protect them from rheumatic fever every time they got a fever. And there was another illness that ran in my family called Sydenham chorea, which damages the heart valve. So everybody got very nervous and gave antibiotics very quickly if a child was sick. So you have people who have like a lot of early antibiotic use, and then they have a lot of immune complex things and possibly food allergies, and there's problems in the gut from all of this. And then you have food allergies. Children eat foods that bother them. Maybe they become allergic to milk and wheat, who knows, and then they get acid stomach and they get all these gut symptoms, and they have always thrown antacids and acid blocking medications. So there goes the acid in the stomach, which protects your stomach from other bacteria and is the place where H. pylori likes to live. So it's kind of like, you know, that what you were saying about preserving the ecology and not, you know, kill all the wolves, and then what happens? The elks take over and the elks destroy the habitat for other animals and plants and things like that. So
yeah, so we have, as you say, we have a balanced ecosystem. It's an ecosystem that has evolved since time immemorial. And because we've had very important scourges like tuberculosis and cholera and rheumatic fever, it was developing antibiotics was a great boon, and I would never want to live in a world without antibiotics. But because we have overused them so much, we're degrading that balance, and organisms like H. pylori are disappearing. In part, it's good, but in part, it's bad. And in net, we don't yet know what the answer is, but right now, the medical profession keeps thinking Helicobacter is an enemy. The only good Helicobacter is a dead one. And again, I'm afraid that we may be doing more harm than we're doing good.
I would assume so. I've seen us do it before. So another aspect of this is that even a part-time use of antibiotics can contribute to having type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune attack on the islet cells, the insulin-producing cells. So that's never
good. Well, we don't know this for sure, but that's our hypothesis.
I see.
Type 1 diabetes, which is the juvenile form of diabetes that children get, what we can say two things. The first is that it's getting more common.
Mm-hmm.
It appears to be doubling in incidence about every 20 years. And that's all over the developed world. And the other thing we can say is that it's getting younger. Kids are getting it at an earlier and earlier age, suggesting that something very serious is going on early in life.
Mm-hmm.
So our hypothesis is that one thing that's driving this is antibiotic use and cesarean sections, for example, which change our microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been doing experiments in mice. There are certain mice that are genetically susceptible to get this type 1 diabetes. And we have evidence that we can accelerate their development of diabetes by giving them antibiotics early in life. So that's consistent with the hypothesis. We have not proven it, but it is evidence that supports the idea that this may be contributing to the epidemic.
You talk about something in the book that I like a lot, which is the idea that we don't just have brains in our head. We have brains in our gut. We have brains in our, you know, our nervous system. All of this is, you talk about the 100 million neurons in the gut that are functioning almost like a brain, and it's part of your nervous system, which makes serotonin, and then you've got an effect possibly on with autism and antibiotics. But antibiotics also affect estrogen pathways and clearance, too. So very complicated what they do.
Yeah, well, we know that the bacteria in the gut affect estrogens in women.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was first discovered 50 years ago when they started using birth control pills that when women went on antibiotics, it changed the birth control effects. Many of the women got breakthrough bleeding. And that told us that the antibiotics were affecting hormones. And the question was how, and it's because the bacteria in the gut that estrogen circulates through the gut as part of its normal physiology. It's not just in the bloodstream, but it goes out in the bile, into the intestine, and then it's reabsorbed. Why nature does that, we don't know, but nature does. And the composition of the bacteria in the gut determines whether the estrogen is going to be excreted or reabsorbed. So it's kind of like the switch that determines how much estrogen a woman has. So we're very interested in this subject.
Once again, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman on the phone with Martin J. Blaser, MD. He is author of Missing Microbes. Now to the problem. We've got these hospital sicknesses, and we've got antibiotic-resistant bugs. We've got C. diff infections, MRSA, and apparently use of antibiotics is making people more susceptible. The use of antibiotics reduces people's, it makes them more resistant. Anyway, you get what I'm saying. So this is one of the other real frightening things about too much antibiotic use.
Yes. I mean, this has been known for a long time. And that is that the more antibiotics we take, the more we select for antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Charles Darwin was right. There is natural selection. There is survival of the fittest. And when we put antibiotics into the environment, there is selection for bacteria that are resistant. Our overuse of antibiotics is only making that worse. And one of the consequences is that some of our antibiotics that we need for times of trouble are becoming less and less effective. So it's kind of a double whammy. We're losing our good antibiotics, and they won't be there when we need them. And we're overusing them when we don't need them, and that's causing other kinds of health consequences. All of these stem from the overuse of antibiotics.
So there's this big question, and you have a whole chapter and more to discuss what to do, what the solutions are. And one of the interesting new thoughts is to, I mean, we know about things like trying to prime the immune system by giving people parasites and hookworms and things. And we've discovered that sometimes reintroducing these things can get the immune system going again. So in a similar way, replacing the microbiome with these microbes, replacing the microbiota, one direct way is to do fecal transplantation. I'm stumbling because it's who wants this going down your nose into your stomach, or in maybe a better solution is to do an enema.
Well,
but it's frightening. But there it is, right?
Let me just interrupt because right now, fecal transplants are used for people who are really seriously ill.
Yeah, I got it.
This is not a casual thing.
No.
there's an infection called C. difficile,
yes.
Or we call it C. diff, just to make it short, that can cause bouts and bouts of diarrhea. People can lose 20, 50 pounds of weight. Sometimes people die from it. In
mm-hmm.
the book,
mm-hmm.
I talk about a wonderful woman who was perfectly healthy, got an antibiotic from her dentist, and 2 weeks later she was dead because of C. diff. So it can be a terrible, life-threatening infection. But interestingly, it's due to the imbalance of the microbes in the gut because of antibiotics. This bad microbe kind of takes off. It just blooms, and it just causes tremendous damage to the gut. And so in recent years, doctors have learned that if you give such sick people normal microbiomes from healthy people through fecal transplant, either they take it through their nose or through their rectum, these people can be cured. So it's actually quite dramatic. There was a big clinical trial that was done comparing the fecal transplants to normal therapy, and they had to stop the trial because the
mm-hmm.
fecal transplant was so much better.
Yeah, no,
again,
it's clear.
This is for a very serious infection, a very small number of people. But because of its success,
right.
it kind of proves the principle that
right.
if you restore the ecosystem, you can restore health.
No, I think it's fabulous. It's just, it is, you know, it makes you shudder, but there it is.
Well, the question, though, is, you know, I'm not at all advocating it for people who are not seriously ill with C. diff infection. We have to do research to understand if we give fecal transplants to people who have inflammatory bowel disease or IBS
mm-hmm.
or obesity,
mm-hmm.
are we going to do more benefit or more harm? We don't know the answer
well,
to that.
Well, yeah, but it makes a certain kind of... If you think it's not, it wouldn't be surprising if it helped, is what I'm trying to say. But it makes me go back to you mentioned probiotic supplements in your book, and you do say that we just don't know, because part of what's tricky about all of this, I mean, none of this is simplistic. It's all complex. The human, you know, we're like a planet. We're hosting and harvest. You know, we have all this stuff going on inside of. So you have to be very cautious and thoughtful about what you do with the balance. And you do point out that individuals are individuals, and their microbiota is going to be different than somebody else's. And you mentioned that with the fecal transplantation, you know, if they can find somebody who's a family member, you want to try to find. But the truth is that what's going on with your microbes has a lot to do with how you lived, where you lived, what your physical, psychological, and interior, you know, what you ate and how you cared for yourself, environments, all these environments. So you can't always know whether you're putting the right ones in. You mentioned the problem of you add the wrong thing in and it's going to be competing with something else that might be beneficial to you and you don't know. But with probiotics, it's pretty much the same thing. I mean, you still don't know. All you can do is the supplement companies, who I don't think are as... I'm trying to be cautious about what I say so that I don't inflame you, but certainly the pharmaceutical companies have a long list of people dying, and I'd like to see the list of deaths from supplements. I track this with the CDC and
well,
stuff. So,
you know, what we can say is that these supplements are generally safe. It's pretty clear that they're generally safe unless somebody has pre-existing illness, like people are getting transplants or they're on chemotherapy. But they're pretty safe. But the question is, do they work? Are they effective? And what I can say is that most of them, there are hundreds of products out there, all of them say probiotic, but very few of them have actually been tested or tested with any degree of rigor. And so I don't know whether they're any better than sugar pills.
Well, except that human beings, for as long as human beings have been cooking and processing foods, have been, and even before probably, have been fermenting foods. And we know what microbes are in fermented foods, and you can also read about and study about, as some books like any of Liz Lipsky's books will talk about, especially her more recent one, which is the Digestion Connection, Dr. Lipsky's book is going to talk about the fact that we are beginning to find out that certain kinds of yeast and funguses and probiotics can treat, like we know that you can use something that's similar to baker's yeast to stop diarrhea in patients.
Well,
it works very efficiently.
You know, I have to say, most of this is untested. Fermentation was designed to preserve food. So in the days before refrigeration, you could preserve foods for long periods of time. And it works. And many fermented foods are delicious. I eat yogurt every day. I've been eating it every day for decades. But I eat it because it's delicious. I don't know whether it's giving me a health benefit or not.
Well, we know that it's with yogurt, it depends on how sour it was and how it was done. But certainly with sauerkraut and pickles and other fermented vegetables and fruits, we know for certain that they are imparting microbiota. We know that the microbes are in there and they're getting into the system.
Yes, they're imparting microbiota, but actually they don't last very long. In fact, when I eat yogurt, for example, if I were to check my stools, those bacteria would be present in the yogurt today, but they'd be gone tomorrow.
But most
because
people,
the body has its own bacteria, and they don't like invaders. They don't like they just like themselves. So they throw out the invaders. They throw out the ones in sauerkraut and the ones in other fermented foods because those aren't human organisms. What's important are the ancient organisms that we've inherited over the millennia and that are disappearing.
I get it.
Missing microbes is all about.
Yeah, no, and I do appreciate your sense of caution and thoughtfulness about this because I agree with you that you have to be cautious about the balance of these things and you don't just sort of blithely go in, you know, to a place where there's some poison oak and drop napalm because you want to get rid of the poison oak. You have to be thoughtful. All I'm trying to say is that considering the enormity of the problem and how serious this is, that we're losing this balance, that using whatever we know we can use, you know, in a prudent and thoughtful way, I mean, I think people can experiment with probiotics. I usually suggest just eating fermented foods every day, but I have found that some probiotics, very carefully made, you have to be able to select for whether or not you have food sensitivity. So you have to watch for what's in there and whether or not you react to the prebiotics and, you know, whether it's grown on milk and whatnot. And even so, I've seen people with very sensitive systems do better on them. And that's anecdotal, and I get it. I'm just saying that until the medical establishment finds a way to, as you say, begin to develop better testing, better diagnostic testing, better health public health policies like in France where they really limit the antibiotic use, maybe not so much broad spectrum as you say. All of those things are important, and then just food producers have to be restricted. That what else can we do? I mean, the reason I think the fetal transplantation is interesting is because it makes sense. It's a little bit like swabbing the vagina of a birthing mother and placing it on the face of the baby if they're not having a vaginal birth.
Well,
there's a thought. Maybe we should be going that way.
This is really where the frontier is. It's a very active field of scientific investigation. And again, I wrote Missing Microbes to make the public aware of some of the issues that are underlying all this and to provide an explanation for why we have all these diseases that have been rising over these recent decades, diseases that are mysterious and that don't seem connected, like inflammatory bowel disease or diabetes or obesity or autism. Mm. You know, if you have 10 diseases that all rise in parallel, they could have 10 different causes. or they could have a single cause, one thing underlying it all that may be fueling the increase. And that's my hypothesis, what's going on with the microbiota, that we're altering it, and that's what's driving all these diseases. And that's the idea I try to lay out in Missing Microbes.
Well, and I think that it is one of many things. I mean, as you mentioned Rachel Carson, and we know that a lot of the pesticides and various other toxic chemicals that are in the environment, there's new research on what they're calling obesogens. So there's a number of things that are acting on the body, and if the body doesn't have its native protection in the form of these microbes, then it's going to be more susceptible to any insult, any immune insult. So I agree with you. I think it's a great book. I just feel like I always want to give people somewhere to go with this. And I mean, certainly we can all make choices, but many of us were bombarded with antibiotics very early on, and we can sort of avoid them now as much as possible. But boy, it's bucking popular culture, and it's hard to do. And, you know, people are putting, you know, I noticed after I read the book when I got into the bathtub and I'm soaping up, I just soap my underarms and my feet and various things. And I'm thinking, in some countries, they don't bathe every day. So every time I do that, I'm destroying these colonies. I was thinking of Dr. Seuss and his, what was the Smallville, the town Smallville, where there's all these tiny, oh, I'm destroying whole villages and I'm doing this.
Well, my fear is that a lot of this is cumulative. It's the antibiotics, it's the antibacterial soaps, mm-hmm. triclosan, and many of the products.
Clothing.
It's the antibiotics in the foods because of the use on the farm. And, you know, every time we're exposed, if a couple of species went extinct, over time it would be a lot. And there's evidence that we have less diversity within us than people in other parts of the world where people are so-called less developed than we are, in Africa and South America.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my fear, is that we're losing diversity just as we are outside on the planet, inside our bodies.
So are you bathing less?
You know, I like to bathe.
Yeah, so do I. But we are. I mean, they are, what I mentioned about the clothing, they're imbuing clothing with nanoparticles of antibacterial and antimicrobial stuff. Horrifying.
Well, yeah. Lena, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on your show.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Martin Blaser, MD, he is the author of Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. We will put his website up on our website. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. So, Jeffrey, do you have any short comments? You don't have a brief comment on what you just heard? No comments. Okay. Well, I guess I will comment. I do like this book. I think that he takes a very complex subject and handles it and covers the research and the thinking in it, which I think is very important. And I do think myself that there is some benefit in eating fermented foods, and I guess that was clear, in taking probiotics. But I do think that people have to be cautious with probiotics because some of the products may be irritating for some people, so you have to shop carefully. And I'll leave it there. I want to thank you so much for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier extended access to our over 500 archive shows with our library card feature. Find out about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. You can reach us by email at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.